Poverty is an ever-present and ever-growing problem in our world, our nation, our state, and our neighborhood. And in parts of western Wisconsin, poverty is on the rise. But at the same time, state and federal dollars for poverty assistance programs are drying up. This hour, we'll talk about how widespread poverty is in our region, what types of assistance are available, and what we as individuals can do to help. I'm Rich Kramer. This is The West Side. I'm joined in the studio by three women who are on the local front lines of the fight against poverty. First, I'd like to welcome Julie Cowan-Bomar. Julie is a family living educator with the Eau Claire County UW Extension Office. Julie Cowan-Bomar, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And next, I'd like to welcome Anna Cardarella. Anna is an assistant director of project employment with Western Dairyland, a community action agency based in Eau Claire. Anna Cardarella, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And I understand we've got some breaking news with regards to you and your relationship with the agency.
Yes, I was offered and accepted the position of executive director for Western Dairyland, and I begin those duties June 1st.
Fantastic. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I imagine your days will get a little bit busier.
They will. Thank you.
And finally, but last but not least, I should say, I'd like to welcome Nancy Kraft. Nancy is the Director of Program and Resource Development with Indian Head Community Action Agency based in Ladysmith. Nancy Kraft, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you for inviting me.
Our pleasure. And we'd like to welcome some listeners to get in on the program as well. If you've got a question or a comment for any of our guests, give us a call at 800-228-5615. That number again is 1-800-228-5615. And you can also post a question or a comment on the West Side Facebook page, and I will do my darndest to get it on the air. So have you, the listener, have you or someone else close to you experienced poverty? Where do you think the balance should be struck between cutting back on government budgets, whether it be federal, local, or state, and assistance programs for those in need? Give us a call, 800-228-5615, or post on the West Side Facebook page. Now, I'd like to start with Julie Cowan-Bomar. There's a lot of perceptions involved when people think about poverty. For some, it may be the classic image of the person on the street with a cardboard sign, or others might think of a poverty as someone pushing a shopping cart or digging through garbage cans to get, you know, aluminum. So for the sake of our discussion, let's begin with a definition of what poverty is. What does it look like? Julie Cowan-Bomar.
Well, we have some federal definitions that really are so pervasive that they really guide all of the work that we do because they're connected to money. Mm-hmm. And so a federal definition of poverty would mean that you're unable to meet basic needs, food, shelter, you know, those basic needs. I think we can look at an expanded version of that, and we see those numbers rising as well. And that would mean that you're not able to secure self-sufficiency for your family. And that might mean that you're in unstable housing or that your transportation is unreliable. So we can broaden that definition, and that also is an accurate perception of reality.
Now, with the federal definitions, there's a dollar amount, is there not?
Yes.
And it's whenever I see the different qualifications for to be able to get in on these programs that are assistance for people, it's always 100% or 200% of the poverty level. What is that dollar amount?
Yeah, that's an important question because it's a real solid determinant of what people can qualify for. So the poverty guidelines for 2012 say that if you're a family of four and you're making $23,000 or less, then you're in poverty. And so that's the same in all 48 contiguous states. So that can be the same in, you know, Barron County, and it can be the same in Eau Claire or New York City.
Okay.
And so it really doesn't take into account cost of living and job availability, transportation, and that sort of thing. And so in we know it's often, in many cases, too low of a number, that you can't make it on that amount at all. And so many different programs and many different scholars of poverty, as well as people on the front lines, understand they need to pull that up a little bit in order to capture those who are near poor or are in poverty in their region. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about a number like 185% of poverty, we're going up another 85% beyond that number and including those people. And so that's where we can start to build a wider safety net for mm-hmm. those people who are also in danger of falling into worse poverty.
Okay. And Anna Cardarella,
yes.
What does it look like? Does poverty look like one thing or another? I mean, do people like myself see it every day?
Yes. And, you know, expanding more on what Julie was talking about, I think about for a family of four that's earning, that's, you know, below poverty, $23,000 a year, that's, you know, let's say two adults, two children, that's one adult making $11 an hour, working 40 hours a week to support a family of four, and that is the poverty line. And again, that's, you know, throughout the United States except for Hawaii and Alaska. But what we see, it's not, again, it's not what we alluded to in the beginning. It's not necessarily the homeless man sleeping under a bridge. It's not the single mother, you know, it is the single mother too, but that's not everyone. I am seeing anecdotally in my work, I've been at Western Dairyland for almost 9 years. And one of the programs that I run is a transportation program that helps people to repair or put a down payment on a vehicle for employment to get to work, that they have jobs, but they have transportation barriers. Our areas are, you know, increasingly rural. I cover mm-hmm. Buffalo, Clare, Jackson, and Trempealeau counties.
Mass transit isn't an option.
Yes. There's a lot of shift work. There's, you know, the buses don't run at certain times. There's child care issues. But anyway, so for these folks, you know, getting to work and getting these, I used to see historically a lot of female-headed households with, you know, maybe two children, mom working in home health care. Lately, in the past 3 years, I've seen an extraordinary number of people over 50 that I didn't used to see before, that may own their own homes, they're not unemployed, they're underemployed. Their position had been eliminated. Now they're not working in their field anymore. These are folks who never had to ask for assistance in the past and now find that they don't have, you know, health insurance. They're paying a huge percentage, up to 75% of their net income on health insurance premiums. Mm-hmm. So I'm seeing more and more of that. I'm a numbers person. And so, you know, and for reporting, we, you know, for those of us working in this area, we have to report all these demographics. And my numbers of people applying for my services over 50 has increased, you know, over 200% within the past couple of years.
Wow. Wow. Just a whole different dynamic.
It's different than what you ever would have think. You wouldn't think that, you know, Anne down the street, who's a, you know, 60-year-old homeowner, mm-hmm. is in poverty, but she may be.
And Nancy Kraft, Anna Cardarella just got to a few of the causes of poverty, like health insurance costs or health costs and underemployment. What other causes are there in Western Wisconsin? I mean, is poverty linked to, say, a plant closure, or can we sum it up that easily?
Well, in the six counties that Indian Head serves, which is Burnett, Washburn, Sawyer, Rusk, Taylor, and Clark, we have seen just in the past few years an exponential increase in poverty. And I think much of it can be attributed to plants closing. For instance, in Rusk County, that has been problematic. One thing I wanted to say, you know, sometimes people, when they think of poverty, they only think of urban areas mm-hmm. as
right.
being impoverished. But rural poverty, I think, is almost as bad. Some of our schools have close to 65 or even higher percent children on free and reduced lunches. And I think we have to differentiate between two types of poverty. There's circumstantially people who are now find themselves in poverty, and there's people who chronic poverty. And mm-hmm. the one thing that I know we have seen in our food pantries, and we have food pantries in each of our counties. Just for instance, in 2008, just a few years ago, we had 3,822 unduplicated individuals who were accessing food through our food pantries. In 2011, there were 11,610 unduplicated individuals, which is more than a threefold increase. And we even have farmers now coming to the food pantry. And so it's just prevalent all over. And I think it's actually getting worse, as you can see from these numbers.
Well, what gives? I mean, the nation and state are still reeling, of course, from what has been described as the Great Recession. But there are sporadic news reports that things are turning around. Unemployment's going down in the state. The unemployment data is always a big political thing when it comes out. You know, Democrats say, oh, there's jobs lost. Republicans say, but the unemployment rate is going down. So if it does seem to be getting a little bit better, Nancy Kraft, why are we seeing poverty increase?
Well, I kind of question some of those numbers with unemployment going down. Sometimes I think it's a matter of people stopping to look, because there aren't jobs. One program that we had funding for, a transitional jobs program, I think we had like 170 applicants in the short period of not even 2 years that came to us for assistance. And it's amazing. We were able to place 82 of these folks in unsubsidized employment, which was the ultimate goal of mm-hmm. this program. But finding positions for people in rural areas where you have limited opportunity, we had to be very creative. And I'm amazed that we were able to place 82 folks in unsubsidized jobs. But another thing that we really need to be looking at, I think, is a job can be a minimum wage job. Is it a living wage job? Can a family be supported on some of these jobs? Do these jobs provide health care benefits?
But I also think, too, that we're talking about underemployment. We're talking about folks that, you know, maybe the unemployment numbers have gone down, but these jobs aren't all 40-hour week jobs. Mm-hmm. You know, you could have someone that is working, you know, at a sustainable wage for 40 hours a week. Their hours get cut. Now they're doing something, you know, making two-thirds of what they were making before, but they're working 20 hours a week, 25 hours a week. So they're not counted as unemployed, but they are definitely feeling the effects of poverty and unemployment and underemployment.
A reminder to our listeners, we're talking about poverty in western Wisconsin, and we'd like to hear from you as well. Give us a call at 800-228-5615. If you've got a story of yourself or someone you know experiencing poverty, we'd like to hear it. If you're a little shy about the subject, but we definitely would like to hear. And also, what do you think about, you know, government assistance programs? Is it good money after bad, or is it something that we owe to those citizens that need help? 800-228-5615. We've got wide open phone lines. I'm going to get a little philosophical here, Julie Cowan-Bomar. This underemployment, who is to blame for poverty? Is it the individual, or is it the society? Where do we begin with a question like that?
It's a great question. And poverty is so complex. And what we know from the research is that there are sometimes structural issues like employment situations or discrimination or historical relationships in communities that can really drag people into poverty or keep them from moving out of it. But also there's individual choices that also play into it. Bad decisions or decisions that hurt people stick with them for a long time. A felony, for example, or you get evicted because you didn't pay the rent. Good luck getting another rental. So it's individual choices, that's true, and it's structural issues as well. And so when I work with community groups and try to organize in the community, I say it's all true. Now what are we going to do about it? If we can identify what are some of the problems, then let's come up with grassroots solutions to affect those. And we need all kinds of programs, whether they're structural policy changes or whether they're programs that really affect individuals.
Anna Cardarella of Western Dairyland, you'd like to chime in.
And I agree, and I want to expand, too, that so much of it is education. It's generational. I give the example for me that, when I was 20 years old and wanted to buy a car, my parents co-signed for me, and so I was able to build my credit and do things. But if you're someone that no one in your family has ever had an auto loan, a checking account, a traditional mortgage, it becomes almost impossible for you to get those things without some assistance, without some education.
All right. We'll get to what we can do to help the situation a little later in the program. Right now, we'll take our first break. We're talking about poverty in Western Wisconsin, how widespread it is, what programs are available to those facing it, and what we can all do to help. We'll hear more from our guests, Anna Cardarella of Western Dairyland, Nancy Kraft of Indian Head Community Action, and Julie Cowan-Bomar of UW Extension right after this break. This is The West Side.
Support for WPR comes from the Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra. Cheryl Dring emcees as the orchestra brings Mahler's Second Symphony to the stage in Gantner Hall of Haas Fine Arts Center on May 12th. Information is available at cvsymphony.org.
The Bare Bones Ensemble presents Just Local Theater. Kevin McMullen performs with Take Three at the Heidi, shows up with a tune and more. Seussical Jr. hits the Old Gem Theater. Jim Oliver and director Kathy Welch have details. Liz Reuter from the Chippewa Valley Museum provides a look at Museums Week and what's planned. Bruce Taylor's here with a verse or two, and we'll hear about A Night at the Mabel, Tainter, to keep the stage active and the gallery occupied. We'll expound on it all during Spectrum West tomorrow at 5 p.m. on this Ideas Network station.
I'm Rich Kramer, and this is The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking this hour about a problem that never goes away, and in fact, it's getting worse in some parts of our region. That problem is poverty, and it affects everyone, whether directly or not. I'm joined by Director of Program and Resource Development at Indian Head Community Action Agency, Nancy Kraft, Assistant Director of Project Employment with Western Dairyland, Anna Cardarella, and Family Living Educator with UW Extension in Eau Claire County, Julie Cowan-Bomar. And to our listeners, if you or someone close to you knows the struggles brought on by poverty, call in and share your story. Also, if you volunteer your time or your resources to help end poverty, let us know. We want to hear that story as well. The number is 800-228-5615. That number again is 800-228-5615. Toll free and wide open phone lines are available to you, the listener, right now. You can also post a question or a comment on our Facebook page. So we were just getting into a little bit about maybe some of the causes of poverty and the impossible question of who is to blame. But now I want to talk about some specifics in our region. And Nancy Kraft, according to some data that I found from the 2010 census, the counties in our listening area with the highest poverty rates are, in order from lowest to highest, Eau Claire County, Jackson County, and Rusk County. In Rusk County, that poverty rate, according to the census, again, the numbers are a little old at this point, but 19.6% for overall poverty rate, and I believe it was 32% for child poverty rate. Why is Rusk County so hard hit?
Well, I think a major reason is our two major manufacturing plants in Rusk County were window and door manufacturers. And when the construction industry tanked a few years ago, there were major layoffs in those two plants. And so I think that was really a major reason that we found so many people on the poverty rolls then.
And how about Ladysmith is what? Is that the biggest town or city in Rusk County?
Yes. And
So the fact that it's pretty rural, that plays into it again as well, right?
Oh, very definitely. And then when these people get laid off, where can they go?
Sure.
There are no other opportunities in the area.
And then now, Julie Cowan-Bomar, what about Eau Claire County? There seems that there's all kinds of manufacturing plants Whether they're hiring or not is another matter, I guess. But there seems to be more opportunity. Why is Eau Claire in the top three?
Well, Eau Claire County has historically had a high poverty rate, at least in the last decade or so. And we've had the largest increase in the state in the past decade for the percentage of people living below the poverty line, a 7% increase. It's complex again. Part of it is we are, besides the healthcare careers and the education that you see through some of the colleges and universities, we also have a very strong service sector here, which tend to be lower paying jobs.
Sure.
And if you're going to try to get into those healthcare fields, you're going to need advanced degrees, at least advanced training. And for many people, they don't have that in the area. We also really need to think about those people who are not only classified in poverty, but those people who are near poverty. And in Eau Claire County, one out of three people, 34%, is either in poverty or low income. So those are the near poor, and that's also incredibly high. It shocks a lot of people. Our school systems also report over 40% on an average kids are on free or reduced lunch. Some schools in our community are at 80% above 80%.
82, is it?
Yes. Yeah. So it's shocking, and you know, just and it is increasing, and I think a lot of it is the underemployment, the availability of jobs. It all weaves together.
Is there any hope that with, you know, when the economy, it always goes in cycles. When it does come back, hopefully, will these numbers go down?
I think that they will. Yeah. I think that, you know, a good paying job is a good way out of it. Also, hopefully, by people getting advanced degrees or getting to college, getting some skill training, that will also help. But it's costly as well. So you have to have a multi-pronged approach to it, and jobs are not the only answer because, as you know, Anna explained, sometimes you can have a job and you're still living in poverty.
And let's go to Anna Cardarelli.
Yes.
I know Western Dalian does cover Jackson County,
yeah.
And why is Jackson in the top three, number two in our 12-county region for the highest poverty rate?
Well, as Julie spoke about, too, education. I think the state average for adults 25 or over with a bachelor's degree is about 25% currently, and mm-hmm. Jackson County is, you know, quite below that. There's a brain drain. We hear a lot of employers talking about that the young, bright kids go away to college and stay away. They don't come back and bring their dollars into the community. Jackson County, you know, outside of Black River Falls, is increasingly rural. You know, I'm someone that has worked a lot in transportation, and transportation barriers are a real problem for our folks. Without public transportation in these rural areas, it's the difference between, you know, keeping or losing a job.
Mm. All right, let's go to the phones right now. We've got three callers on the line, and very good to hear and good to see that. If anyone else wants to get in on the conversation, call 800-228-5615. If you're not able to get right through, keep trying. We'll have a spot open for you sooner or later. Right now, we're going to go to Amory, and we've got Brent on the phone. Brent, thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a comment. I'm actually was a victim of the 83 recession, 1983,
mm-hmm.
and it was kind of a situation where I decided to go back to school, try and improve my situation. And I never would have made it if it hadn't been for the public assistance that I had received. I was married, had a wife, child on the way. I remember moving to Eau Claire on a Saturday, starting school on Monday, and I had $100 in my pocket.
Wow. If you don't mind me asking, what types of assistance are we talking here?
Well, in that case, I got educational assistance, of course, through grants.
Mm-hmm.
I also got public assistance, food stamps, housing allowances, things of that nature. But I also worked during that time, as well as carrying usually a 18-credit load to get through as fast as I could. But I just always remember one statistic I heard in an econ class was essentially the dollar spent to assist people in those situations to get out of poverty, get the education, the taxes they pay would be pretty much 20 to 1.
Wow. Okay.
And I would have to attest, since that's been since for like last 26, I have definitely been paying that $20 to the 1.
All right.
I guess I just hope that that we continue to see programs that help people who do want to go to school and lift themselves up. That would be my comment.
So, what about the whole balance between fiscal responsibility at the local, state, federal government levels and these kind of assistance programs? Should we be putting more money into them, do you think, Brent?
A lot of times I think it depends on the situation, too. I think the local government has to kind of look at that from that sense, too. You know, if we do assist people, state governments, we assist people, get them into careers where the, especially employers, manufacturing right now needs skilled employees. Mm-hmm. Help people get into those fields so that they can earn livable incomes.
All right. Well, Brent, glad to hear that you're back on your feet and doing well. I really appreciate the call. And again, the number 800-228-5615, 800-228-5615. To call in and share your story on the West Side regarding poverty and whether or not you are actively involved in helping fight against it, or what you think about the whole balance of, you know, government assistance versus fiscal responsibility. Give us a call. You can also share your question or comment on our Facebook page at the West Side. Nancy Kraft, any thoughts on Brent's statement?
Yes, it's kind of ironic. As I was driving here today, I was listening to Talk of the Nation, and former Senator Bill Bradley was on. And he was talking about the country and where it's at and how the country can be improved. And he made a statement that kind of stuck in my mind, and I think this kind of parallels what the caller was saying. He was saying, just as we are concerned about our own welfare, we should be concerned about our neighbors' welfare as well. I mean, after all, when people say, oh, you know, this is not the role of the government, my personal feeling is we are the government. And this is really the role, I think, to provide a safety net for people. And I think when we do this, we're creating a civil society. And I think that's so critical. Because if your civil society breaks down, what do you have? And so I really think we need to look out for each other and be concerned about each other's welfare. And as the caller said, he got that little assistance back then, but look at how much he's given back now. I mean, that's what we're about, I think, in this country.
All right. And now back to the phones. Now we've got a caller, I assume, from Superior. I'm not sure if our signal makes it quite too Superior, far up north, but we're going to hear from Ron next. Ron, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'm from Superior area, but I'm down near Eau Claire right now.
Okay.
And I'm homeless. I've been homeless since 2 days before Christmas. I was renting a house in Drummond, Wisconsin, and I was out of town, and I came back home 2 days before Christmas. And all my things were sitting out in the yard, because the landlord couldn't wait for till the first to come around for the other $200 I owed him. So therefore, I got taken for my $500 deposit, and I have an ex in Duluth and two children. And just so I can spend a little time with my sons, I rent a motel room in Superior on Saturday nights, and I pick my sons up. And I spend Saturday nights with them. And I think it's real unfair that someone could just move me out into the snow and change the locks. And they say in the housing manual for tenants and landlords that it's illegal for the landlord to move you out just like that without going to court and whatnot. But they did it to me. And I did file a court hearing on it. I went and had the paperwork all get up, but I didn't have the $90 to go through with it. So here I am. I'm still homeless. And my comment is, I think that people that are on Social Security should be able to make more than $80 a month, and they would be more encouraged to go to work to supplement their $700 income or whatever it is. But I think it was real wrong that the people that put me out in the snow on December 24th were really wrong about that, and I'm still hurt over it.
Well, best of luck to you, Ron. I really appreciate you sharing your story. And Julie Cowan-Bomar, what about renters' rights and when a person loses a place to live, does that kind of, is that a springboard to further problems?
Yeah. Oh, poverty? Absolutely. I mean, it's a skyrocket down in terms of health, in terms of even, you know, getting a job, for example. You need a place so that the employer can contact you. So it can really send people into desperate circumstances right away. I'm hearing very similar stories to Ron in Eau Claire area, as well as in other communities that I collaborate with. And we're seeing more desperation. People are, let's say if they can't pay the rent, they hold out all the way until they're physically evicted from the home. And for a lot of people, that's new. We're seeing other anecdotal stories about homelessness that are very serious. For example, people sleeping in the caves along the Eau Claire River, it's almost always been single men. In the last couple years, we've seen families in there. There's 215 homeless kids in the Eau Claire Area School District, and when they first started looking at these numbers, it was as low as 60. Hmm. So we're definitely seeing people in much more serious circumstances. Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure, I'm not sure if Indian Head or Western Dairyland are involved in this, but there's a twice a year there is a count, a homeless point in time
the
count.
Point in time.
And what the data from that shows that the homelessness is on the rise as well. Anna Cardrell?
Yes, it is. And, you know, we are lucky in our Eau Claire area that, you know, some people that are very concerned about homeless have come together, and that there were some, you know, needs, some gaps that the Sojourner House opened, you know, to handle single men and women.
In
Eau Claire. Also, though, with our homeless population, I'm currently working with two families that are living in motels. That, you know, when I asked them, how do they cook their food? How do they have a crock pot, and, you know, this is their children come there and stay there, and, you know, they're living out of motels. But it's not, when you think of homeless too, it's not always the person, you know, like we said, you know, Julie, it is the people in the caves, but it's people that, you know, every night they're going to a different friend's house, a different relative, and taking their children, and just the, you know, how hard that is on the family. I just, you know.
And with the breakdown, you've got also veterans, a large population of homeless veterans also. That's just one of the greatest travesties to me. But so with renters' rights, I believe that there was a bill recently that it kind of gave landlords a little more power as far as evicting people. I'm not sure on the details, so anyway.
And that was in Madison, I believe, that they changed, you know, that because Madison historically, the rights have been very, you know, tenant-focused.
Sure.
But that has been overturned. You know, one resource for Ron is, you know, there's not so many local ones, but the Tenant Resource Center out of Madison, I hope that he is contacted. If he's still listening and could, you know, try to look them up and give them a call and see if there's any help.
Okay. Well, so, Anna, does this Ron's situation, is that sound like an illegal eviction?
I mean, by no means, I'm not an expert in tenant rights or tenant law.
Sure.
But, you know, was he given a 5-day notice to quit? I've never heard of such a thing. I mean, there has to be a court proceeding. You have to file paperwork. There should be, you know, if the sheriff should come and move them out, not just, you know, the locks changed and their things are outside the door. I have not heard of this, but I think that Ron should definitely, you know, try to call the Tenant Resource Center.
There you go, Ron. And thanks again for the call. Right now we'll go to Chippewa, and we've got Margie on the phone. And Margie, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to tell a little bit about what's happened with me. I'm 65 years old now. I had to file a age discrimination in order to keep on working until I was 62. And so then when I retired, after working all my life, I raised two kids. I didn't go on welfare. I worked to raise my kids on minimum wage jobs, and my Social Security check is not enough to live on. And if it wasn't for food stamps and HUD, I would be living under a bridge. Hmm. You can't keep a car running. It's not enough to live on. I got the SSI. They said, yes, I was under this poverty line. I could get about $12 from state and $86 from the federal or vice versa, one way like that. And then they took $50 away from my food stamps and raised my rent. The HUD raised my rent. Mm. So I gained $13 on that. And it's just impossible to get by, and I'm a good person, and I've worked hard all my life. And the HUD man says, well, you know, there's something to be said for working for a living. Like, I hadn't worked since I was 14 years old and paid my own. I paid my dues. I paid my Social Security. I deserve to live better than in the public housing, which you're next door to somebody that's some schizophrenic young man that's threatening to kill the people he works for. And
well,
that's not right.
Margie, I'd like to have Nancy Kraft of Indian Head Community Action Agency respond to your thoughts.
Well, my thoughts really are that this is more commonplace. Especially in some of our rural counties. In Burnett County, one of our counties, 38% of the population are 50 years old and above. And when you look at all of our counties, it's at least a fifth or more of the population is elderly. And we have seen situations where the elderly have to make choices. This month, am I going to pay my fuel? Am I going to get my medication? Am I going to buy food? And so we're constantly looking for grants to provide a safety net for these folks, because you cannot go without your medication and you cannot live in 50-degree housing. Mm. But with fuel going up so high, some of these folks have to make choices, which is really unfair.
So, Nancy Kraft, hopefully we've got Margie on the phone yet. What options are available to her through programs like, or through agencies like Indian Head or Western Dairyland?
Well, I know Indian Head has some emergency grants that we get. Unfortunately, it depends which county you live in, because there are restrictions for some of these funds. But I know we do offer some housing assistance, like through TBRA.
What's that, TBRA?
Tenant-based rental assistance.
Okay.
And so there are other government programs. There's fuel assistance that you can get. And then certainly the food pantries. That's one way to supplement the food. And even though we as an agency have food pantries in each of our counties, many of the churches are also now opening up food pantries, because with some of these, you're restricted to come just once a month. And that's not going to get you through a whole month.
Right. Well, Margie, thanks so much for sharing your situation with us, and best of luck to you. We'll take our final break here on the west side, but when we come back, we'll do a brief discussion of what other programs are available to people that are facing poverty, no matter what their age is. We're talking with Julie Cowan-Bomar of UW Extension, Nancy Kraft of Indian Head Community Action Agency, and Anna Cardarella of Western Dairyland. We'll be right back.
Support for WPR comes from Wasco Windows, manufacturing and installing replacement windows and doors for Wisconsin's climate. Locations throughout southeast Wisconsin and the Fox Valley, and online at wascowindows.com.
Is the weekday commute getting to you?
I'm driving right now as I'm online. Propane tanker.
The office getting a little crazy?
I'm impressed, Miss Harrison. I never saw anybody hit an author before.
Well, just a little move we learned in biblio-taekwondo.
On-the-job perks getting smaller?
My very own three-hole punch!
Right. Escape from it all this weekend.
A Prairie Home Companion, Saturday evening at 5 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from the UW-Eau Claire Artist Series. The Amelia Piano Trio performs works by Haydn, Beethoven, and Shostakovich in Haas Fine Arts Center's Gantner Concert Hall on May 10th. Information available at uwec.edu/activities.
I'm Rich Kramer, and you're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio stations 88.3 WHWC and 88.7 WRFW in River Falls. Thanks for joining us. We're talking about poverty in western Wisconsin, how widespread it is, what programs are available to those facing it, and how those programs are being funded, at what level they're being funded from the federal, state, local governments. I'm joined by Director of Program and Resource Development with Indian Head Community Action Agency, Nancy Kraft, Assistant Director of Project Employment with Western Dairyland, Anna Cardarella, and Family Living Educator with UW Extension, Julie Cowan-Bomar. And to our listeners, we've had a few great calls. We want to hear more from you. Give us a call at 800-228-5615. Let us know your situation. Have you or someone close to you experienced or are you experiencing poverty as we speak? How? Why? And what have you done or what have you seeked out as far as assistance? And are you finding that it's hard to find assistance in situations? The number is 800-228-5615. That number again is 800-228-5615. Now, we've got the two community action agencies represented here tonight, but I want to talk to you, Julie Cowan-Bomar. You're a family living educator, and I'm just wondering, what do you do? Do you educate people on how to be financially literate, or what types of things?
Yeah, it's a variety of things. I have a great job, and I am able to concentrate and focus the resources of the University of Wisconsin system on social problems in communities. When I started this job, poverty came right to the top. And so what a lot of my role is to help facilitate community responses to poverty. And I have to gear it to where the community's at. So a lot of it is awareness raising. I do a lot of I build a lot of resources. I do reports like this that help kind of keep my finger on the pulse of the community. And, for example, I'm working with colleagues across the Chippewa Valley. We're making a documentary about poverty in the Chippewa Valley that anybody can take out and show service organizations or groups so that we help raise the level of awareness. That's fundamental.
Do we have an idea when that might come out?
Hopefully in the fall. It's a long project.
Yeah, I know. Documentaries take many months.
Absolutely.
Many months.
But also what I help do is to work with others in the community to collaborate and develop responses. I was just in a meeting this afternoon down at Sojourner's House, which is an overnight facility that was created in 18 months by a concerned group of individuals to address a really critical issue in our community. And we're talking about helping ramp up volunteer efforts in Eau Claire so that folks can help people who are really in a crisis situation, help them to navigate the system and figure out what those resources are, or help them fill out a job application. Because we're dealing with some of the folks, especially that are in the homeless shelters, you know, there may be mental health issues, there may be chronic diseases, things that really are huge barriers to people.
Now let's go to our community action agencies. First, Anna Cardarella. I know both agencies have numerous programs, and for the sake of time, what is the most used program that Western Dairyland offers or administers?
Well, I would say currently, just because of the timeliness of this, is our crisis energy assistance. Mandated that, you know, until April 15th that, you know, your heat cannot be shut off until then, that, you know, that is a law in Wisconsin. And so right now we're seeing folks that are getting the threat of disconnect and are desperate. And so, you know, we have crisis energy assistance to help folks bring the gaps to try to make payment arrangements to get, you know, their heat and electricity back going. I mean, we've had a very mild, you know, spring.
Yeah.
This March was, you know, unusual. But, you know, we also have Mays where we have quite a bit of snow in April and snow. So, it can be cold. So that is what we're seeing. We also, to serve people in poverty, we have homeless shelters for families. We have our financial counseling that's free and open to anyone. So,
all right, and Nancy Kraft, same question to you. What are the most utilized programs, or what are you especially proud of at Indian Head?
Well, we have 13, and I'm proud of all of them. But our community services centers, I think, have really provided that safety net for families and individuals in poverty. But I think our transitional jobs program was just an amazing success. Unfortunately, the funding for that program is coming to an end, and we don't know where we're going to get new funding. I want to mention just a couple more. Weatherization has been a very large program for us. I know we weatherized 537 homes in 2011, and so that really helps people to be able to control their energy costs a little bit more. And a final program I'm really proud of is our Fresh Start program, where we are working with youth who are out of school, who dropped out, and they go back to get their education, high school diploma or GED, and they're also learning about the construction trades and the process and doing community service. So
teach a man to fish, right?
Teach them to build a house.
Teach them to build a house.
We also have Fresh Start at-risk youth age 16 to 24, and they build houses that we sell to income-eligible families. So, yes. I mean, it is a wonderful program.
So there are programs. There's help out there for those who seek it out. Now, let's talk about federal, state, and local funding for agencies like yours that that offer all these programs. And Nancy Kraft, part of your job is grant writing. Federal and local, state and local support is drying up.
It's drying up. It's becoming much more competitive. A grant just recently that we did not get, there were 178 applicants for a federal program requesting $55 million, and all they had to offer was $3,500,000. So the odds certainly are not very good. And so the funding definitely is drying up at the federal level. It's drying up at the state level. And even with foundations who are dependent on sometimes contributions from people, that money is drying up as well. And, you know, there's a real chronic need, behavioral health. I've been looking for funding, for over a year now for behavioral health assistance, because it seems when people are in poverty, there could be substance abuse issues, there could be behavioral health issues, and that's just an impossible area to find. But until we can help people in those areas, you know, people really cannot become self-sufficient.
Right. Let's go to the phones, probably for the last time this evening, since we are getting close to the top of the hour. But we're going to go to Cornell, and we've got Dan on the line. Dan, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Yes, thanks for taking my call, and hello to you and your guests.
Hello.
And I'd like to speak to the people that were calling in that are down and out on their luck. And I think it would help us all if we learned who our representatives are in government, and learn who has our best interests at heart and who doesn't, and exercise your right to vote. That's my comment, and thank you for having this program.
Yeah, thank you for calling in. Great point, Dan. Nancy Kraft, let's go to you.
Oh, I couldn't agree more.
Because we're seeing just this latest budget in the state, at least, there were some pretty serious cuts all around. Of course, we had a deficit, and there's that whole argument that could go on for days and days and weeks and years.
Well, you know, my feeling is the people who have the most power are not necessarily the policymakers. Yes, they're the ones who are making the laws right now, but it's the people who put them into power. And so I think it really behooves us to educate people on the issues and, you know, so that people maybe do vote in their own best interests. We can't tell people how to vote, but we need to make them aware of where the support lies for these programs.
All right. Julie Cowan-Bromar.
Yes. Just from a research-based perspective, we know that policies have affected poverty, that they have brought rates down, whether you were talking about seniors and Social Security. When that became available, we saw the whole demographics of poverty change. You're looking at maybe early childhood education programs. A wonderful cost-benefit analysis has been done on those programs, and we know that the money that you put in pays off in the end, because those kids are less likely to go to jail. They're more likely to go on for education. So economically, the research shows that it's a great payoff. So, I mean, that's one of the things that we do at the university is really try to help illustrate, where the cost-benefit analysis is and what's really effective in the long run.
And Anna Cartarella, speaking of politicians, Politicians like Mitt Romney, for one, is one that's been in the news, and he says that assistance programs such as welfare – I'm paraphrasing here, of course – but assistance programs like welfare or food stamps and the like, they're not helping people. Instead, he claims, or he has claimed, that they're actually diminishing people's self-esteem or their drive to go and get a job. What do you say to that?
I say that, you know, it's a safety net that is necessary, and, you know, and that we look at folks, and again, we're looking at a lot of we're looking at jobs and positions that people we have people that are working full time, but people are spending so much money on health care or child care or other things. So to give them just that, you know, little bit of assistance, we're looking at, you know, we talked about earlier, like Brent, our caller, talked about the multiplier effect. That's what they call it in economics, about, you know, that the money that you spend, that how it goes back, you know, twofold into the economy. That's what we're looking at. So I think that, you know, it makes a great tagline to talk about chronic poverty, and also, you know, but it also, when we have callers like Brent that call in, and that there's someone that took these temporarily and now are college educated, are working productive citizens, giving back to the community, they're not talking about that. And that's who we're looking to help. And that's why we're here and why we do what we do.
All right. We've got one final call we're going to squeeze in here, and then we're going to talk a little bit about what we as individuals can do, all of us, to help the situation. We've got Dan from Shawano. Dan, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. I'm really enjoying the program. Thank you.
Hey, we appreciate it.
And I'm just this is more just an observation, and I think I'll try to contain my thoughts as much as possible, but I think that possibly what we need to do as a society is we need to stop looking at the people that are living in poverty. I think we have a tendency as a society to objectify them and blame them. And I think that there needs to be a shift in the way that we look at the people around us that are less fortunate. Every one of us, maybe 90% of us, are one paycheck away from being in their shoes. And I think we live in a constant state of fear that we are going to be like that. So we tend to protect ourselves, and we tend to not reach out to people. I don't know what the answer is, but I think there needs to be a shift in the way that we view people.
All right.
It's very complicated, obviously. But
it's a big question, a big, long discussion to be had, probably never-ending discussion. But, Dan, we are running out of time. Thank you so much for that point. Julie Cowan-Bomar, how do we change that perception?
I think recognizing that it is our neighbor that we need to be concerned about is a great perspective, and it could be us. Whatever motivates you, whether it's your faith, whether it's your politics, whether it's your neighborly spirit, whatever it is, do it. I mean, follow it, because that really does make a difference in communities. So maybe you don't agree with a government spending policy, but you might agree to help out your neighbor. And so we all have – it's a call to action for all of us.
All right. We've got just about a minute left. And I'll start with Anna Cardarella. What do we, as the regular Joe on the street that has some time or maybe some extra, what do they do to help fight poverty?
Well, again, as Julie said, it's, you know, it's our neighbors in poverty. It's what we can do is we can volunteer our time. There are so many organizations that are looking for volunteers. We can donate to organizations that we are passionate about.
Okay. Nancy Kraft?
I think we need to educate ourselves on the issues and be up on what's going on politically.
And Julie Cowan-Bomar?
I think we got to help our neighbor. Grassroots solutions all the way.
I'd like to thank my guests, Anna Cardarella of Western Dairyland, Nancy Kraft of Indian Head Community Action Agency, and Julie Cowan-Bomar of UW Extension. Thank you all for a great discussion. I'd also like to thank the people that called in and all the listeners out there. A big thanks to Team Westside as well, including Mort Cypress for on-air production, Henry Lippold for producing the program, Grace Fair for promotions, and Ellen Zamaripa and Dean Collenbeck for keeping us all on track. And to our listeners, again, a big thanks to you and for calling in. Tune in on the March 31st. We're going to have a 23rd State Senate District Recall Candidate Forum with Senator Terry Moulton and Kristen Dexter. This is The West Side.